There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. I want to welcome you back once again to a very interesting show. This is the first of a series of shows where we'll be bringing our good friends from SEIU to do their tally report. They'll be bringing us a report each week from Tallahassee to let us know what every good union member should know, what every good progressive activist should know. So stick around, 7:15 on the quarter hour. You're going to hear from our good friends, our union brothers and sisters, so stick around. Also tonight, we've got a report from Ray Siemens on the next coming up, Awake the State. We're going to have Chris Costello from Sierra Club talking to us about some of the water quality issues out in the West Coast and the Clean Water Initiative. We may also be talking to Drew Martin from the Palm Beach County Water Board. We've also got Leah Barber-Hines, who's going to be telling us about the ACA and what we need to know about the progress that's being made. And also we've got Mindy Fetterman, who'll be talking to us about her project, the inner project. So stick around. First, I want to preview this interview with Ray Siemens, giving us an update on Awake the State. I'd like to welcome, ladies and gentlemen, Ray Siemens with Progress Florida. Your title exactly, Ray, is?
I'm the online director for Progress Florida.
And online is one of the great things about Progress Florida. Ray, we've got another Awake the State coming up. Why don't you give us the lowdown?
Yeah, so Awake the State is happening again this year on, as we've always done since 2011, on the first day of legislative session. We have locally led rallies happening throughout the state. This year we have 14 different events taking place from Pensacola to Miami and just about every place in between. And this year we're calling on Governor Scott and the legislature to pass a budget that will restore our middle class and not give more unnecessary tax giveaways to corporate special interests who don't need them. And I think really for the first time with this particular set of Awake the State rallies, you'll be seeing folks calling out Governor Scott and his legislative allies for a lot of the attacks that they have made against the middle class over the last few years, and also talking about ways that we can actually restore the middle class and bringing people back into the middle class who've fallen out. So things like raising the minimum wage and pay equity for women, expanding access to quality, affordable health care, fully funding public education in this state, protecting our land and our water, and safeguarding our voting rights and strengthening our voting rights as well. So that's just going to be some of the things that are happening. And some of our events are really unique this year. One of the neat things about having each of these events locally led is the fact that folks take things in very interesting directions, and folks are very innovative and entrepreneurial. So in Tampa, there's going to be a band and multiple speakers. In Palm Beach, there's going to be a food truck roundup, which I just find fascinating. In Miami, there's going to be street theater because it's Miami, things like that. So we've got a lot of neat events planned, all really trying to fire up the progressive base on the first day of legislative session, paving the way for a good 2014.
Well, thank you so much, Ray. You were one of the instrumental voices in getting this started. In fact, I would even say the instrumental voice in initially kicking this idea off. How does it feel to be a proud papa of an event that is statewide and that really is a clarion call to the progressive community?
Well, obviously, I'm incredibly proud of the work that all of our local event organizers have done over the last couple months, just for this set of Awake the State events alone. But really, everyone who's organized an Awake the State event since we started this in 2011, and literally the hundreds of people who have either organized events or lead local or state progressive organizations who have helped promote and turn out people to these events. This is very much a movement-wide team effort from literally just about every wing of the progressive movement in Florida. So everyone's involved from teachers to labor to women's groups, environmental organizations, civil rights organizations, healthcare folks, just and everything in between. And this is really the result of their hard work at the end of the day. And, yeah, I couldn't be prouder of everyone.
Well, Ray, thank you so much for ringing that bell, and we really appreciate you giving us an update. And tell people again, what's the website they can find out more information?
Absolutely. If folks want to search and find an Awake the State event close to them and sign up, they can go to awakethestate.com. Again, that's awakethestate.com. You can also Google it. You can also find us on Facebook. We've got a very vibrant Awake the State page. And certainly I would also encourage folks, if they'd like to help spread the word, you know, to post something to their Facebook profile or send an email to their friends or share any one of the cool graphics that we have highlighting different issues on the from the Awake the State Facebook page.
Well, thanks again for joining us, and congratulations again. And let us all help awake the state. Thanks again, Ray.
Thank you, Rick.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Next thing we're going to do is some news. And remember, the news stories that we do, you can get the links and more information by going to averyvoice.com. So stick around, averyvoice.com. And now the news. Hey, come on home. All is forgiven. Japan said on Monday it would lift the evacuation order on an area around the failed Fukushima nuclear plant for the first time since it was hit by tsunami and earthquake in 2011, allowing some residents to return home despite the radiation concerns. Government was expected to announce the order on April 1st, and about 300 residents in Tomura City will be allowed to return to their homes about 20 kilometers west of Fukushima Daiichi plant. But city officials were not sure how many of them would. Lifting the evacuation order on April 1st is desirable. Fool's Day. How tragic is that? Tomura Mayor Yuki Tumitsuka said earlier this month, more than 130,000 residents were forced to leave their homes since the country's worst nuclear disaster, and many are not willing to return to live in the area. Tokyo established a no-go zone within 20 kilometers radius soon after the plant suffered a triple meltdown March 2011. Despite decontamination efforts, levels of radiation have not changed much because of radioactive contamination in the mountains and forests in the region, local activist Setsuki Kurada said. Water cleaning halted. More on the Fukushima front. GG Press. Troubled radioactive water cleanup system at the stricken Fukushima No. 1 nuclear plant was hit by a new problem Wednesday, operator Tokyo Electric Power Company said. An alarm went off about 12:20, warning of the problem in one of the three lines of the Advanced Liquid Processing System, or ALPS, TEPCO said. The system is designed to remove most radioactive material from the water used to cool the damaged reactors at the power plant in Fukushima. After the alarm sounded, a pump for sending tainted water into the equipment, where the radioactive materials are observed, stopped working. The halted line was one of the two in test operation. The third line, still suspended, ALPS has only one that's currently active. The daily water treatment capacity is 250 tons per line. ALPS is crucial to TEPCO's efforts to clean up the ever-increasing amounts of radioactive water, but as it announced, it encountered a series of problems. Two lines are being test-operated to ensure uninterrupted operations. Health risk or not, cesium levels high in hundreds of Fukushima reservoirs. This from Shinji Fujiwara, a staff writer of Tai Shimbun. Fukushima, very high levels of accumulated radioactive cesium have been detected in the mud of hundreds of reservoirs used to irrigate farmland in Fukushima Prefecture, where agriculture is a key industry. The finding comes from prefecture authorities continue to assuage public concerns of contaminated food following the triple meltdown at Fukushima's number one nuclear power plant 3 years ago. A joint survey by the prefecture government and a branch office of the Farm Ministry found that levels exceeded 8,000 becquerels per kilogram of soil in 576 reservoirs. In 14 of those cases, the levels topped 100,000 becquerels. Central government said the reservoirs, many of which are located in residential areas, are not covered by the decontamination program. So don't worry about it. We're just not going to decontaminate them. The survey covered 1,939 reservoirs, or slightly more than half of the 3,730 in Fukushima Prefecture used by agriculture. Prefecture authorities, fearing the contaminated mud from the reservoirs may reach farmland and create a health hazard for residents, are asking the central government to remove the waste. Contaminated soil exceeding 8,000 becquerels corresponds to designated waste that must be removed at the central government initiative. According to the government, the Environmental Ministry, the amount of waste exceeds 100,000 becquerels accounts for 1/2,000 or less of the debris produced as a result of decontamination work in the Fukushima Prefecture. The prefecture government and Tokohu Regional Agricultural Administration offices of the Ministry of Agriculture examined the mud of 1,939 of the reservoirs from February 2012 to last December. It's the first such survey to be done. Officials say 108 of the 576 contaminated reservoirs are in zones where residents were evacuated due to the March 2011 nuclear disaster. The remaining 468 reservoirs are located outside the evacuation orders and are still supplying water to rice paddies and other farmland. The areas are mainly located in the central part of the prefecture, including the cities of Fukushima and Date. Officials with the prefecture farmland management section said cesium that was discharged from the nuclear plant immediately after the accident attached to dust in the air and fell to the reservoirs along with the rain. And of course there was that dumping, but we're not going to talk about that. Cesium that ended up on surrounding mountains was washed down into the reservoirs along with earth and mud and sand, they added. The reservoirs are shaped like earthenware mortars. It's easy for earth and sand to accumulate, said an official in the section. Because of that, contaminated soil in surrounding areas often ends up in the reservoir, making their contamination levels high. And let's skip ahead a little bit. It's pretty exciting stuff. But if the Farm Ministry removed mud from the reservoirs, the work would not be covered by funds for decontamination. As a result, the central government, not TEPCO, could be obliged to shoulder the costs. According to calculations by the prefecture government farmland management section, the cost to decontaminate all the reservoirs, including transportation of the waste to temporary storage, would be 15.4 billion yen. That's only a mere $154 million. The central government has earmarked 260 billion yen for decontamination work in the budget for fiscal 2014 that starts in April. Decontamination for the reservoirs can be accomplished with less than one-tenth of the central government's budget for decontamination work, said Kayozaki Kikukushi, head of the farmland management section. If the central government provides that amount to us, Fukushima Prefecture, we can do the contamination work ourselves. Of the five reservoirs with cesium levels exceeding 100,000 becquerels, in areas other than the evacuation zone, the mud in Miyoshi Reservoir in the Takagi district of Motoima, some 55 kilometers west of the stricken Fukushima plant, has the highest contamination at 370,000 becquerels. The reservoir sits in the central part of the 200,000 square meter hilltop residential area with 392 households and a senior high school there. Cesium levels in the reservoir are so low as to below beyond detection. Now let's see if we can get to one more story before we invite our union brothers and sisters on. A horrible medical mystery affects the area surrounding the Hanford plant in Washington State, and they're calling this a mystery. Elizabeth Cohen, senior medical correspondent, Yakima Valley, Washington. A horrible medical mystery has unfolded. An alarming rate of birth defects, Sarah Barron, a nurse in the region and first to report the cases of encephaly. Babies born with much of their brain and skull missing. I was just stunned, said Barron. In a couple of months' time, it's unheard of. They're terrible, tragic outcomes. Barron's shocking discovery prompted an investigation by the state health department, which shows that in three counties in a three-year period, there were 23 cases of anencephaly, a rate four times the national average. Mandy Starr, Washington State Health Department epidemiologist, said, "We have not found an answer, and that's the very frustrating part, because this is such a devastating diagnosis for the women to have." The state hasn't spoke to any of the families who had the babies with birth defects, and that they find unsupportable. Okay, now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to bring on our union guests. They're going to bring you the news from Tallahassee.
Hi.
Hi there. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. This.
Hello there. Do I have my SEIU brothers and sisters on?
This
you
is
sure
the boss.
Do. This is Rebecca Wakefield.
Great.
How are you?
Welcome, welcome. I want to welcome you and thank you for joining us. We are so looking forward to this ongoing Tallahassee Report. So, ladies and gentlemen, Subhash and Rebecca, take it away.
Okay, thank you, Rick. I'll just start real briefly for those of you who don't know what SEIU is. That acronym stands for Service Employees International Union, and we represent roughly 55,000 members in four locals throughout the state, mostly in South and Central Florida, but also in other locations. And we've got everybody from healthcare workers, nurses, doctors, healthcare professionals, nursing home techs, and we've got school workers, city workers, you know, you name it, we've got it in our union. So we're a really good cross-section of hardworking Florida residents who, you know, are just looking at how do we take care of our families, how do we make sure that we all have good schools, quality jobs, access to affordable health care, and those basic issues. So that's, you know, part of what we wanted to do with this show is just to really drill down and make it simple for people to figure out what's going on in Tallahassee and how does it affect us.
That's great.
And this is doing it. Oh, sorry about that.
Go ahead, weigh in. Hello?
Subhash, go ahead.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, no, and this is Subhash. Thank you so much for this opportunity. And, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and every time a person starts off a sentence by saying I'm not a conspiracy theorist, they usually say something crazy. But the one thing I got to say about the state of Florida is sometimes I don't think that it was an accident that the state capital is 8 hours away from most big South Central Florida cities, about 4 hours away from the I-4 corridor, two hours and change away from Jacksonville. Sometimes I think that's for a reason, and sometimes I think that the things that happen in that state house, in that little state house in Tallahassee, 8 hours away from where I live, 4 hours away from where a lot of my friends in Tampa and Orlando live, even though it has a direct impact on our day-to-day lives, a lot of those things happen without us even knowing that they're happening. And a lot of the issues that we're fighting against right now are because things that affect us in our day-to-day lives, whether or not we'll have health care, whether or not we'll have a job, whether or not we will get killed in the street, are being made far, far, far away from us and far, far away from our consciousness. So one of the things we want to do is we want to bring what's happening in the state house in Tallahassee closer to you, whether you live in Jacksonville, whether you live in Miami, whether you live in Orlando, whether you live in Tampa. And that's partially what we want to do because there's a lot of things going on in the state that really need fixing, and we won't be able to tell if they need fixing or not if we don't know what's happening.
I can't thank you enough. I think this is an invaluable service. So tell me, we're just about to start this new, I'm going to say probably devastating 2014 session. What's going on? What do you know so far?
Okay, so right, you know, the session will start on Tuesday, so, you know, start your engines, everyone. There's going to be a lot of issues that will be on tap, and Subhash definitely has a line on a number of those things. A couple of things I wanted to mention is the pension system. Unfortunately, this year, as last year, the House is going to go after the pension system. They're trying to, you know, destabilize it and close it to new hires and make them go into a 401k system, which is not as good as the state pension system, which is one of the best in the world and very stable and has meant a rising middle class for a lot of people around the state who are fortunate enough to be in the state pension system. So we'll definitely be paying attention to that, not only because it affects our members, but our neighbors, our friends, and our communities. Another issue for some of the healthcare unions, particularly mine in Miami, I work for Local 1991, and we're nurses and doctors and other healthcare professionals at the state's largest public hospital. It's a safety net hospital as well. One of our issues is trauma centers. You know, we have a great trauma center, but partially due to all the changes with Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, a number of private hospitals want to open trauma centers, and that has to be done very, very carefully so that you don't impact a trauma center for a public safety net hospital. And you want to end up with a better trauma network so that if you are in an accident, you can go anywhere and get the best care possible. There's a lot of different ways that that could go wrong, and so we'll definitely be keeping an eye on that. Another issue is undocumented students. There's a proposal to potentially allow them to pay in-state tuition rates, and that's an excellent idea, and we'll definitely be in support of that. I know Subhash has a couple of other hot button issues to mention, and so I'll cede the floor to him.
Thank you very much,
Rebecca. Definitely. And I think there's an overall theme, and I think the overall theme is whatever their state capital has been doing, whatever our governor has been working on for the past couple of days, the governor likes to say that it's working. And I think most of us in Florida agree that whatever the hell they're doing is just simply not working for us, right? And it's not working for us whether we're working people. It's not working for us if we're sick folks. It's not working for us if we come from certain communities that often don't get the attention in the state that we need. Whatever's happening in Florida, I think there's one thing that our really diverse state can agree on. Whatever the hell they're doing in the state capital is not working for us. And I think it's really important for us to especially spend the next month or so paying attention to how our politicians are addressing what's not working for us. Whether it's like, you know, as Rebecca said, like there's almost a million people, 700,000, maybe give or take 100,000 folks in the state that could get health care tomorrow if the state house in Tallahassee would just literally take $1 billion that's sitting there waiting for Floridians to take to expand Medicaid. Tomorrow, over 700,000 people would likely get health care in the state. And, you know, Charlie Crist said something that folks in the union have been saying for a while, which is like six people are dying a day for lack of health care. Six people are dying a day for lack of health care. And that's six people that are dying a day while we're sitting there not taking billions of dollars that's meant for this state. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind is the fact that 1.8 million people in Florida can't vote because they're returning citizens. And what that means is a long time ago when they were youth, they committed youthful indiscretions maybe, and because of a conviction many, many, many years ago, folk Desmond Mead, who's a third-year law student who works with the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, a third-year law student who did something really stupid 20 years ago that he'd never, ever do again, he can't vote. 1.8 million people like him can't vote. And those 1.8 million people generally don't look like Charlie Crist, like Rick Scott's brother. They look like folks that they look like the 20% of the state that's often left out of a lot of policies. And on top of that, a couple years ago, our state legislature made it a lot harder for people like 102-year-old Desalene Victor to vote. And so in the last presidential election, a 102-year-old woman spent 3 hours in the hot Florida sun just to vote. We got to pay attention to see if our politicians in Florida are going to fix that. And then, you know, something Rebecca alluded to and that I think is important and that I think there's bipartisan desire to move is when we talk about a broken immigration system, we aren't just talking about the federal government. So the federal government helped break the immigration system, but there's plenty that's broken in the way that the state treats immigrants as well. And what I don't just mean folks that are immigrants. I mean folks that have called Florida their home for their entire lives. I mean young people that have went to school here, that went to high school here, that are trying to go to college here, and other states sometimes want them. There is a bill to grant those folks in-state tuition. Now they're paying twice the tuition to go to school, to go to the same schools that the guys that they graduated high school with, that the young people they went to grade school with went to. They're paying sometimes twice the tuition. There's some bipartisan pressure to change that now, and there's also bipartisan pressure to make sure that everyone that can drive can get a license in the state to make sure that our streets are completely safe, that our insurance rates go down, and so that's something else I'd pay attention to as well. But across the board in general, whether it's the fact that there's young people around the state that are, after the Jordan Davis verdict, are saying, does Florida love us? People are actually saying that in the street. Whether it's old folks that are saying, are we going to die because our state isn't going to take millions of dollars, billions of dollars from the federal government to grant us health care. Whether it's folks that are saying, like, we just want to be able to vote without dying of a heat stroke. It's really important for us to watch what's happening in Tallahassee over the next month or so to see if these politicians are willing to make this state work for us.
Subhash, right. That was an excellent assessment. Go ahead, Rebecca.
And just to add to that, you know, something I always say is with the Medicaid expansion argument, healthcare expansion. It's clear that people in Florida want it, because even given the problems with the website, even given a state that has tried very hard to block people from participating in the Affordable Care Act, we're one of the highest states for people registering anyways. So people want this. Not only that, even if you don't care about people's health care, care about the jobs. You know, studies have shown that we're talking about, you know, 100,000 new jobs potential that would be created by fully implementing all of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act in Florida. That's a lot of jobs. And for a governor and a legislature that says that they're about job creation and that tag, it's working, well, this is an example of how it's not working. And, you know, so there's, you know, besides our voices on this show, we also want to bring you, you know, some of the experts and activists who are fighting on particular issues and have them speak as well, so that you get a fresh perspective and you get a sense of, you know, I mean, we're being very general here, but, you know, in future shows we'll be talking more specifically about specific issues and how things are going down in Tallahassee, so that people can get on the phone, get on the web, and take action. And that's really what we're trying to do, and call out our leaders and make sure that they know that they're being watched and that people are listening. I mean, if you just look at what has happened in the state in the last 4 years, we have had, you know, everyone's paying taxes and we expect services for that. But if you look at what our governor and this legislature have done, that they've turned down billions not only in healthcare incentives, but for public transportation projects and other things. So we're talking about a lot of money that's not flowing into the state that could be right now, a lot of jobs that could have been created that are not here now. And at the same time, they're shifting billions more money in public education money towards for-profit operators and away from the public schools. And they're giving billions in corporate handouts for alleged job creation that never really develops. And so those are the things that people need to be aware of, so that when they're reading the newspaper, when they're talking around the water cooler, they have some information about what's really happening.
And there's a few things that folks are doing right away that if you're in Florida and you really want things to change, that you can plug into. And the very first thing's happening tomorrow on March 3rd at around 10 a.m. in the state capitol in Tallahassee. It's called Moral Mondays. And Moral Mondays is basically an amalgam of different folks around the state, including the Florida AFL-CIO, including the NAACP, including SEIU, including Mi Familia Vota, that's really pushing for a change from things ranging from the healthcare system to rights restoration to the way folks are voting to the way folks are being treated in the court system across the board. So if you really, really, really want Florida to start caring about us, I would plug into Moral Mondays. You can get more information on the NAACP's website at naacp.org and do a search for Moral Mondays. There's also flyers going all over the place. Then on top of that, the day after, there's actions called Awake This State around this state and different cities that similarly are trying to get our politicians in Tallahassee to be accountable to us, accountable to middle-class families, accountable to working families. So to get more information on those rallies, like I said, they're going on around the state on March 1st. You could just visit awakethestate.com. And also, you know, one of the most inspiring actions that happened after the Trayvon Martin verdict was the work of the Dream Defenders, who literally took over the Capitol for a couple months. The Dream Defenders are coming back to the Capitol on Tuesday for their own State of the State address that's going to address how certain young people are treated in this state and the fact that a lot of people in the state don't believe that Florida loves us, as they would say, quote-unquote. So I'd visit their website at dreamdefenders.org. Once again, that's naacp.org, that's awakethestate.com, and that's dreamdefenders.org.
Well, Subhash and Rebecca, I want to thank you so much for bringing us your Tallahassee report. It was wonderful. What a great way to start. And I'll be seeing you again next week. Thanks again.
Great. Thank you so much.
Well, we'll talk to you later. You guys take care, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, now I want to bring you our next guest, the incredible, the talented, the excellent speaker, Miss Chris Costello, Sierra Club, from the West Coast, who's been working on the water project. Chris, welcome.
Thanks, Rick. It's nice to be here with you.
Oh, it's so great, and I certainly appreciate you getting up. I know you haven't been feeling well, but you've joined us. Thanks again. Tell us what's new on the waterfront.
Wow, so much. I'll start with the campaign that you and I have been involved with since really last November, and that is the Floridians Clean Water Declaration Campaign. Kind of a long name, but it really says it all in the name. We have created a new effort, a new campaign, the first wholly collaborative clean water campaign in the state, I think, in the history of the clean water movement here. We have, I believe, 118 different organizations now signed on, working together to, in short, to build a broad base of demand, a public demand for clean water, and that means action to protect our water resources from further degradation, protect that which has not been degraded at this point, and those are very few, and to restore our degraded waters to a point that Floridians can enjoy them once again and depend on them. It is it is in its infancy, this campaign. We began in November, gathering water quality advocates, water quality and quantity advocates, together in one place for one day of planning. In November, we did a public launch of the campaign. In December, we did 16 simultaneous press events on January 22nd, and a little less than 2 weeks ago, we held a rally on the steps of the historic Capitol building in Tallahassee, all in an effort to get the word out to the public that our elected officials, our decision makers when it comes to water, will not do the right thing unless we demand it from them. We make them do it. And so the campaign is now ready to be alive and well and vocal during the legislative session that starts this coming Tuesday.
I'll tell you, that trip to Tallahassee was amazing. People from across the state, everybody informed, people sharing information. You know, I've been involved in the environmental movement for a long time in the state. I remember even before Earth Day, because Earth Day was thought of as a very radical idea. Oh, my God, helping the Earth. Who would have thought of that? But to see all those people together in Tallahassee, to see these events across the state, it gives one hope. It really does.
I agree. I have been an organizer for, yikes, I think 31 years now, and this is the most exciting work I have ever done. There is, unfortunately, in so many movements, territorialism, one-upmanship, different reasons why organizations don't work well together sometimes, and it's always a shame, but it's understandable. But this is the first time that I have ever seen so many organizations, the largest organizations in the state and some of the smallest local organizations in the state, coming together on this very common ground, the Declaration. The Declaration has a list of 6 inalienable rights that Floridians have, that we believe they should have, and 4 responsibilities of the state, the state government, its agencies and industries that use the state's resources, natural resources. We all agree on these rights and responsibilities, and we're using the Declaration to not just get the public signed up and educated, but elected officials, whether they be city, county, state, or federal level, to sign on, to commit to working in good faith to clean up our water problem. It's very exciting.
It's amazing. I heard people talking about problems on the St. John's, people talking about the Indian River Lagoon with the Lacoochee. I mean, just across the state, from giveaways of water resources to privatization, and then, of course, what's coming up next week on the 11th.
Right, right, exactly. The EPA hearing regarding oil drilling or fracking in Southwest Florida. You can't live or visit Florida and not be close to a water quality or quantity crisis these days. You said it all, from the dying corals in the Keys up to the Apalachicola in the Panhandle. Actually, last week, in the month of February, two announcements of harmful algal blooms, green slime outbreaks, were noticed by the Florida Department of Health in Putnam County. Now, years ago, our slime season would be in the summertime, in the warmest months. Harmful algae, any kind of algae, lives and procreates and grows better when the water is warm and the days are longer. When you have water bodies that are being slimed in the month of February, we no longer have a slime season. We have a slime season 12 months a year, and that is a problem, and that is seen. Putnam County is just the tip of the iceberg. Those are lakes and tributaries to the St. John's River, actually, there. So it's a mess, and if we don't, really the basis of this campaign is, if we don't clean up this mess, then Florida is no longer going to be the Florida we know, the world knows. People come here to play and enjoy in our beautiful water, and our beautiful water is no longer beautiful in way too many cases.
There was just an announcement in today's Palm Beach Post that a popular beach area is unsafe to the point where you shouldn't touch the water.
Yeah, there are so many threats to our water resources. If it's not harmful algae, it's fecal bacteria. Depending on the wastewater treatment rules and abilities in different parts of the state, that part of the state still has outflows, raw sewage outflows that are dumped into the coastal waters. Wastewater treatment is one of the major pollutants or polluters in the state. The major ones are fertilizer, whether that be urban or agricultural, depending on what watershed you're in, wastewater treatment, and then animal manure. And all of these things add nitrogen and phosphorus pollution, but when it comes to wastewater treatment or inadequately treated sewage and septic tanks, then you have along with it the fecal bacteria and other types of bacteria that accompany those. You have those in the water too, and so it's really a poisonous mix.
Isn't it true that despite the Republicans' long-touted urge and merge push toward local rule, isn't it true that often they actually fight local municipalities when they're trying to regulate tougher pollution standards?
Oh, yeah. That's just an example of it really isn't it's not home rule. It's not home rule that they're seeking. It's not state rule that it's seeking. It's seeking whatever the large industries want. It really has nothing to do with a true understanding of what is needed at the local level. Local governments have to have the ability to make sure that their particular water bodies and watersheds and waterfront economies are protected. You need local control, but you also need state-level regulation. When it is way too hard for a small local government to take on the kind of polluter industries that wield so much power, so you need the state-level regulation. The state, certainly the Rick Scott administration, has just taken an axe to state-level regulation that we had before and prohibited further regulation, needed regulation. And then, of course, we have a legislature that is attacking home rule at the local level with industry polluter lobbyists behind it all.
One of the things that I've always found ironic was, you know, the government doesn't pay attention to regulations. They don't pay attention to environmental issues. And yet the things they pay attention to, where they were actually spending our tax money to fight EPA rules that were tighter. And then now they've actually joined with polluters in the Chesapeake Bay area to help protect polluters up there. It seems like an odd use of state money.
Boy, you said it. I don't know if there's anything better to say about that. It is, it's ridiculous. It's a crime. It really is a crime, and no one should stand for it. Pam Bondi and the governor should take their names off of that amicus brief. They should renounce their misguided efforts and return whatever resources they spent on this misguided attempt back to what is really needed, regulation and restoration here in the state.
I want to share a story with you that I found. You know, if you report the environmental beat, you're always finding amazing stories, things that you just can't imagine would actually be true. I saw a story out of West Virginia that the people up there literally had their water turned off for weeks, right?
Yep.
So for most of the month, after that pollution incident, the particular one that got publicity, their water was turned off. Now, they just received their bills for that month where the water was turned off, and they all got a bill of $300. Oh, they get to pay extra for polluted water that was turned off. I think that's really remarkable.
Wow. That is an example of how deep the influence of whatever the major industry is in whatever particular watershed is. You see it everywhere. Where in Florida, where big pulp, the paper industry is very powerful. You see actions taken by the state agencies and the local agencies that favor that industry and really forget about taxpayers. What amazes me is that the tax watchdog organizations out there are not alongside us as we attempt to protect our water quality and quantity here in Florida. What we see over and over again, no matter where you are in the states and certainly here in Florida, cleanup projects, tax dollars spent on cleanup projects come from the taxpayers. Polluters aren't paying for the messes they create. And instead of regulating those industries and reducing the cost to taxpayers, they deregulate the industries. And it is a continuous vicious cycle of cleanup project after cleanup project after cleanup project, all paid for by taxpayers, and the polluting industries get off scot-free. And I put scot-free in quotations because Rick Scott is a part of that. It's an abomination. As my campaign with the Sierra Club is called, we affectionately refer to it as the Slime Crimes Campaign. We really do believe that these are crimes committed by the state and polluting industries. And that's why the Floridians Clean Water Declaration campaign is so important. We really need to educate the general public, get beyond the choir, and create the kind of demand that we're going to need in order to get the legislature and the Rick Scott administration to listen.
You know, one of the things that I was surprised at, and happily so, up in Tallahassee, was when I heard somebody was reading from the Florida Constitution saying that literally it is part of the Constitution that the state regulators and the state authorities are supposed to be protecting our environment. So it's literally part of the Constitution that our water resources need to be protected.
It is. It's. You're absolutely right. It is part of the Constitution, and the fact that that part of the Constitution is ignored is something that we need to turn around. I truly believe that there are good legislators that live in both chambers, up in Tallahassee, we need to give them the support and the backing, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. They need to feel our support and our pressure in order to meet the requirements of the Constitution. Until we make them do right, they will continue to get by with the status quo. People always ask me, why won't these legislators do what is right for Florida? And I always say, it's because we're not making them do what's right for Florida. If we don't get up and do something about it, we are to blame. So it really is an issue of taking charge and taking action in whatever way you can.
Chris, let me ask you one last question. For people who want to get involved in protecting our water resources, where can we send them?
The best way to get connected immediately is go to wewantcleanwater.com. That's .com. That is our campaign website. You can connect with us on Facebook at that website. You can see the participating organizations and businesses and get sign the declaration and get connected. Our Facebook page is an active page where people are connecting and communicating on the subject of clean water and water quantity issues every day. And so that's the best way, the easiest way. WeWantCleanWater.com.
Thank you so very much, Chris. You have a wonderful day and night, and keep up the good work. We really need you in the trenches. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Rick. Right back at you. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to bring up our next guest, Mr. Drew Martin of the Palm Beach County Water Board. Drew, welcome. Drew, is that you?
Can
Drew
you
Martin,
hear me?
Is that you?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Rick? Sir. Welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be there. That's the Soil and Water Conservation District, so that not the South Florida Water Management District Governing Board, so I don't want to confuse anyone. But I appreciate the introduction.
Water. Conservation
District.
Great. Drew, tell us, sir, what's new on the East Coast front here?
Well, I think I'm going to piggyback on a lot of the things that Chris has been saying, and that is basically there's a war against the environment when it comes to water quality. And as you were mentioning, West Virginia, there's also North Carolina, where the governor worked for Duke Energy, and basically they went in and they told everybody who worked for their Department of Environmental Protection not to enforce the law. And as a result, there was a huge coal ash spill into a river, and many people's water was poisoned, drinking water, as was happening in West Virginia. We have the same thing going on here in Florida. The Department of Environmental Protection, no employee of the DEP may do any kind of enforcement action, without writing directly to the Deputy Secretary of the DEP for permission. So we basically have defanged all our environmental protection throughout the southern part of the United States. And what we're going to see over time is going to be serious illness amongst many of the people in the population, because you cannot go without environmental protections on your drinking water. And you mentioned about a beach. Anybody who swims in the ocean is going to be affected by these very dangerous toxins and pollutants that DEP is no longer willing to prevent from getting into the water.
You know, it seems to me that this whole thinking that regulation only exists to stifle a business and is all these environmental regulations are counterproductive, I'm afraid that our friends in West Virginia and Arkansas and the Dakotas are getting to see what kind of fruit that bears.
Well, you're absolutely right. And when you look at the XL pipeline and this tar sands oil, that if it leaks, it's heavier than normal oil and cannot be cleaned up. And that could get right into the Ogallala Aquifer, which is one of the most important aquifers for food production in the Midwest. So we're really looking at a turning point in the United States. And business needs a clean environment, but unfortunately, the few people that control business don't care. And I think this whole case of Pam Bondi going up north is a serious problem with her going up to Chesapeake Bay to try to tell the people in Maryland how to manage their water quality rather than focusing on improving the water quality in Florida. It's just another example of the disdain for the public when it comes to the quality of our water.
Drew, just to add to the black humor, the water regulation people of West Virginia, they sent their senior people to the Chesapeake, and they're on the amicus brief as well. They don't believe in regulation there either.
It's absolutely, this whole thing is absolutely gone in. These people have gone insane if they think that agriculture does not need to clean up their act. You cannot allow agriculture to completely pollute the environment. And I think many responsible farmers and ranchers understand that. I don't think we want to tar every single person in the field. But sadly, the most powerful in these industries have convinced many of the other people in the industry that they need to stop environmental protections. And we're looking at right now in the Gulf, thousands of miles of dead zone from the agriculture production in the Midwest, much of it subsidized corn production that really we don't even need.
You know, Drew, I'm really absolutely baffled. When I was growing up as a young man and as a child, everybody who I knew was in agriculture were some of the best stewards of the land. They were environmentally conscious before it became, excuse the expression, popular to be environmentally conscious. They were very good stewards of their land. They realized that if they put poison down, they were going to get poison back. And I don't understand how our agriculture, is it just the big ag mentality that's taken these people from a place where they respected the earth that made their living, and now they just don't care? Do you think
I think you see a lot of local farmers that do very much care about the environment, organic farmers, people that really are doing productive things, and they have a lot of different crops on their farm, and they use the farm animals to fertilize their property, and they use their crops to take up the fertilizers that the farm animals leave behind so that that residual does not wash out into the ocean. But sadly, many of the small farmers have been put out of business over the last 30 years, and that has left us with these giant conglomerates that are controlling the food chain. And these conglomerates, both the large farm agribusiness and the agribusiness that buys their products and the giant retailers that buy their products like Walmart, they don't care about what happens in the environment. They strictly care about how much money they make. And this has been the problem, because farms can be run in a very environmentally beneficial way if they're run properly. There's no reason to have animals inhumanely treated, these huge CAFOs, consolidated animal farming operations, where you have pigs jammed together, cattle jammed together, having to be on antibiotics because they're so sick, being fed feeds that they can't feed, being treated so cruelly, chickens having their beaks removed, you know, their claws growing into the bottom of their feet, hogs that can't even turn around during gestation, cattle in dairies that are never allowed to lick or touch their newborn because they don't want it to affect milk production. I mean, this is a tremendously cruel environment driven by big business, as opposed to people who run a small family farm and operate with all kinds of different plants and animals, and they rotate their crops, and they're very careful how they do things. That can be done, and it's actually much more productive than this giant agribusiness operations. But big business has taken over the farm and the food industry, and that's the problem we're in today.
You know, I was part of the group that went up to Tallahassee with the Clean Water Declaration campaign. And, you know, we heard so many wonderful and terrible stories. We heard about the privatization of a lot of the springs, where South Florida Water Management and other governing boards have basically been giving away water resources. For example, on the St. John's, where there was already a deficit. There was already less water than there used to be. And they're actually privatizing more and more of the water resources. Are we seeing that sort of thing in the Palm Beach, Broward, and Martin County area as well?
Well, I think one of the problems you're going to see is there's a real desire not to conserve water resources, and this is a real problem in Florida. And I was at a lecture today on climate change, and the gentleman said, do you know what the largest crop is in Florida, in the United States? This is actually the United States. And I said, well, is it corn? No, it's not. It's sod. It's lawn. We grow more lawn than any other crop. Nobody
eats
lawn.
Are you kidding?
That is our biggest crop in the United States. And what is happening is lawns, and particularly Florida, in order to have one of these sod lawns, you have to use all kinds of toxic chemicals, herbicide, fertilizers, and this is what Chris Costello is talking about when she's talking about the nitrogen and phosphorus runoff here in Florida into the ocean. And so when I went before the county commission this last week to talk about they want to put hundreds of million dollars into building a new reservoir, and I suggest conservation, they're like, we don't want to do conservation because people would have to change how they landscape. They don't want to ask people to change. If we move away from sod lawns, we would be far better off. Sod lawns also are impermeable. The water runs right off them. They create worse and worse drainage problems. But here in Palm Beach County, every time we have a beautiful open area with native plants and animals living on it, somebody takes that area, puts a for sale sign on it, sells it to a developer, and the developer takes a bulldozer and destroys that entire area, killing all the animals, removing all the plants, and destroying the soils. That area now is one more place that has to be drained rather than a place that can hold water and improve water quality.
Incredible. Everything I know about water resources say that, you know, we have to conserve the good, precious, clean water that we have. There's already so much at risk. And when you said they definitely don't want to conserve, I just find that mind-blowing. It's just beyond irresponsible.
Well, you're absolutely right. And, I mean, this is the thing. We're afraid to ask people to change how they live, even though we in South Florida are confronted with the potential of being underwater in 50 or 100 years. I mean, if that isn't enough incentive to get people to change how they live their lives, what incentive can you give people?
It's truly mind blowing. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you joining us on these evenings. You give us such a good perspective. Are there any other issues we should know about on the East Coast here in the, say, Broward to Martin County area?
I think that something that's very important is to look at growth management laws that are coming up, and there's a House bill coming up, 703, which is basically trying to take away the right of counties to make their own decisions on growth management and water conservation and also protection of wetlands. The state did away with the DCA, the Department of Community Affairs, because they didn't want the state to be able to obstruct any kind of development, but they threw that to the hands of the counties. But every time a county like Martin County does the right thing and they have good people in office and they have a good comprehensive plan, the developers get upset. They go to the legislature and say, this isn't fair. You gave us everything we wanted, because they felt that if they had local control, they could completely dominate the local county commissions and get anything they wanted. But when they get into a county where the county commission doesn't roll over for them, they get upset. They ask the legislature to come in and take the power away from that local county. So there's a bill, HB 703, will attempt to emasculate many of Martin County's protections. So that's a bill that we need to be watching very carefully.
You know, in fact, I did bring that kind of thing up with Chris, and I'm so glad you mentioned it, because this points to me to the incredible hypocrisy of this, you know, playing to the Tea Party, pretending to be for small government. Because if the premise that local government, small government, is better inherently than state government or national government, then you should completely do everything you can to allow local control. And here's an example of where local control is working. Martin County wants to have stricter rules, and yet the state is now stepping up to hinder county governments and city governments from trying to enforce tougher rules. Isn't that true?
That's absolutely correct. Anytime the county or a local government does the correct thing, the state legislature on behalf of the developers and the large agribusiness industries tries to get in there and remove the authority of those local governments to do anything that protects the environment. Basically, I call this a war against the environment, and it's basically going on all throughout the southeastern United States and much of the rest of the United States as well. It's corporations basically emasculating the ability of governments to protect their own populations for environmental damage and just opening up the environment to complete and total destruction, very similar to what we had before Teddy Roosevelt became president over 100 years ago when corporations were so destroying the environment that both parties realized that something had to be done. But today we have one party that is completely captive of the corporate interests and refuses to do anything to protect the population against environmental damage.
You know, trying to find the lemonade in this particular mix, you know, I have to ask you, do you think we're seeing the pendulum swinging way over to corporate side and that this is going to indicate for some people that we really need to change the way this is happening, that we really need to bring that pendulum back? Do you think we're seeing one extreme of the pendulum?
I think we're definitely seeing an extreme of the pendulum, but I don't know if we're ready to see that pendulum return. But when you turn on the television and you watch these people up in West Virginia that basically can't bathe in the water coming out of their taps, and no one found out about it until the public called up and said, my water smells funny, you know, the question is going to be how many people are going to die from poison water before the pendulum swings back? Because right now people have really bought this Kool-Aid that the government doesn't do anything good, but that's not true. The government does many good things. The reason we can open up a box of cereal and not die 2 minutes later is because of food safety. I mean, you cannot have a large food system without food safety laws, without inspections, and people that are doing that for you, because we as individuals can't go and test our water every day to see if it's safe to drink. We can't go out to the beach and test the water before we jump in to see if it's safe to swim. I mean, we need to have government protection. That's what the government is all about, and it's an important part of our lives. So this notion that somehow we can live without government, it just can't happen. We have to have environmental protections, and I'm hoping that eventually people are going to accept that and realize how important it is.
Well, I've talked to activists up in West Virginia as well as journalists up there, and I've asked them, I said, are you seeing the other side? Are you seeing the Teflon groups come out, you know? Are you seeing the Tea Partiers come out and say, no regulation? And, you know, are you seeing the people that are saying, no, let's protect our jobs first? And they said, you know what? When your water stinks, when you can't put your face in it, when you can't brush your teeth in it, you know what? It's pretty goddamn obvious. And, you know, I don't know what it takes for some of these people to get on the stick, but, you know, those of us who are aware, we have to fight. We have to work to protect our environment. That's for sure, because clearly our regulators aren't doing the job.
They can't. They can't do the job, and they get fired if they do. And this is the problem. And it's important for people to understand, because a lot of people say, well, that's okay, I'll just go buy bottled water. Guess what? Bottled water meets no regulation standard. You are simply trusting the corporation that bottles that water to do the right thing. So it's very important for people to understand that you need to have clean water out of the tap. And whether you drink it, you still are bathing in it and cooking in it and using it as drinking water for your pets. So you cannot just decide you're going to go out and buy bottled water and you're going to get away from this.
2 weeks ago, they, quote, declared the water drinkable. And I was talking to a journalist and I said, okay, you live in Charleston. You're a client of that water company, and your water is supposedly safe. Are you drinking it? He said, no, No, I go buy my water. And I said, well, I'm glad that you can. I'm glad that you can afford it. I imagine there's an awful lot of people who live out in the woods who live in the smaller villages and smaller towns, and the government's not providing water anymore. What the heck are they doing? Well, we know what they're doing. They're being exposed to toxic chemicals.
You're absolutely right.
And, I spoke to him last week. The last thing I heard was that they had actually begun testing water inside homes. Now, Drew, let me remind you of one thing. The previous week, when they reopened the schools and told the kids it was okay to drink water, two of the kitchen workers passed out from the fumes in the kitchen. And when the public confronted the school board administration, you know what the school board administrator said? You've heard a lot, but I think this may shock you. He said, you people are just trying to get extra days off school. You just want to play hooky. That was his response.
That's just amazing.
I'm guessing he drank the Kool-Aid, but probably not the water.
Well, it's really frightening when people who want to do a good job, who work all their careers in these agencies, are threatened with being fired for simply trying to enforce the law and protect the public.
Just recently, with all the trouble out at Hanford, a woman who blew the whistle on the Hanford plant's dangerous handling, she was just fired. You know, you got to wonder, is anyone paying attention beside the environmental lobby? It's really amazing.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I think that we've got to bring this under control, and we've got to control this ability of giant corporations to basically dominate the political agenda to the point where we can't protect ourselves from being poisoned from our own drinking water.
Yep, it's pretty shocking. Drew, I want to thank you, sir. If you were to steer people toward getting good information or how could they help, where would you suggest, sir?
Well, the Sierra Club, I think, has a lot of good information. You can go to the Sierra Club website. Just Google Sierra Club. We have our Loxahatchee group in Martin, Palm Beach, and St. Lucie counties. But there are Sierra Clubs all over the state. And certainly Chris Costello's work is extremely important.
Exemplary.
And I would encourage,
absolutely exemplary.
I would encourage people to get involved with her efforts to improve water quality in the state of Florida.
That's the Clean Water Declaration Campaign. You can Google it.
That is correct.
Or look it up on Facebook. Drew, thanks again so much. We always appreciate you coming on. You have a good night, my friend.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's always a pleasure, and thank you for all the great work you do.
Oh, thank you, brother. We try. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, now for our next adventure, I'm going to play a little bit of music while we get ready for our next guest, okay? A little something in the natural vein. That was Spirit, Nature's Way. And now our next guest, I want to bring on Ms. Leah Barber-Hines, CEO of Florida Chain, who's going to talk about the ACA, A Healthier You. I would like to introduce the very charming, talented, and extremely committed to making this a better world, Ms. Leah Barber-Hines. And you are, is it Executive Director?
Yes, so they're technically saying CEO.
Okay, so you are CEO of Florida Chain. Leah.
That's correct.
And tell our audience what exactly is Florida Chain.
Florida Chain is our state's leading consumer healthcare advocacy organization. So Chain stands for Community Health Action Information Network. And we've been around for about 14 years. And basically, we work to protect consumers, and ultimately, we work to ensure access to health care for all. So we try to break down some of this very complicated and as we all know, controversial health policy information into a way that people can understand it and absorb it. And we also work to give tools to people to become part of the process and part of the solution and make their voices heard in the process. And we do also quite a bit of collaboration with bringing partners to the table that have similar goals in mind so that we can amplify our messages and have a strong united front with the important healthcare work that we're all working on.
Well, despite what seems to me quite obvious, that anyone helping people get health care are doing a wonderful thing for society, somehow in this crazy world of ours, we have people who actually pose themselves as opponents of health care. Now, the last time we spoke, it was before the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, and you were gearing up to help people understand what's going on. Because, of course, even before the Affordable Care Act, health insurance access to health care is a complicated arena. And I have to laugh when I hear people suddenly proclaim that, oh, my God, the ACA is making things complicated. Excuse me. As long as there's insurance involved, it's going to be complicated. But you're on the side of the angels. You're trying to help people understand. Where are we now? We're a few months into this. Give us a snapshot of where we stand today, if you would.
Oh, I am happy to. Thank you so much for the opportunity. We all know that the beginning of the rollout was slow, and it was bumpy, and it obviously gave, you know, our opponents quite a bit to talk about. But I will tell you, it has turned around and then some. I think that we're going to have some new numbers coming out soon. So the numbers that I have now are through December. So we have 158,000 people in our state that have enrolled, and 460,000 have completed applications. And I can tell you that as of December, that is the highest number of enrollments in the country for a state with a federally run marketplace, which is what we have. So what that shows you is that we have a very high demand and a ton of interest in accessing affordable and quality health care. And many of the people signing up have never had coverage before. So though we had a bumpy start, it has really turned around. It has been absolutely incredible to be part of watching people that have never had insurance before come in the door and sit down and talk to someone who is assisting and learn what their options are. And so people are qualifying for subsidies, and people are having the opportunity to purchase health coverage, and it's working. And it's really, really just amazing to be part of it.
You know, it seems to me, you know, there's not a human plan out there that doesn't have its little fair share of glitches and maybe we could do betters. But it seems to me that solving the simple problem, the pre-existing condition problem, just solving that seems to me to put us, you know, just miles and miles ahead of where we used to be. So it seems to me a very bitter pill to hear people argue that we'd be better off without it.
Oh, I completely agree. I completely agree. But I'll tell you, it's starting to turn around. The more and more success stories that are getting out there, that's a big part of what Florida Chain is working on and a lot of our partners too, is to get this really good information out in front so that people can see that it's working, and there really are success stories of all kinds popping up all over the state.
You mentioned before that you're involved with helping people understand it, understanding how to get access to it, and helping them find the financial resources that might be available to people. Could you talk a little bit about that? How should they approach that cost factor when the initial sticker shock kicks in?
Well, I mean, what's so incredible about the marketplace is that when you go to the website and you go to apply, you put your information and your income, you know, your income level, and put your information in, it will automatically screen you to see if you're eligible for any sort of help and subsidies. So that information is available through the website, and people have pretty quickly can find out what type of help that they can get. So it's all there. It's built into the system. It's really been so great to see it working for people. And I've also heard plenty of other stories of people, even who might not be qualified, perhaps that, you know, they make too much money, that they're finding that their premiums are lower through the marketplace as well. So it's built into the system to see what sort of help that you can get.
Many states have seen fit to try to help. You know, to try to put their oars in the water, to help people get healthier, to help people get access when they didn't have access. But unfortunately, for some reason, despite the fact that our current governor was in the healthcare business, he and his leadership did not do that. They chose to not help. They chose, in fact, to oppose healthcare access. Now, one of the options, if the state wasn't helping, is there was always discussions of expanding Medicare. Could you address that, or is that outside the area that you work in?
Oh, no. I'm always happy to talk about this. So it's an expansion of Medicaid, and the Medicaid expansion was built into the original Affordable Care Act law. So the marketplace subsidies and the marketplace in general would help a certain segment of the population. And then Medicaid expansion would cover, you know, the rest, which would be the lower income, the people that are really, really in grave need. These are often low-wage workers. For Florida, it's very significant. We estimate there are 760,000 people in what we're calling the coverage gap. And these are often, you know, tourism-type jobs like restaurants and hotels. You know, people that are just working and working but do not have benefits through their jobs. It's also, you know, your daycare workers and people like that. So what happened is that when the Affordable Care Act was under scrutiny by our Supreme Court, when they came back and they said, most of the law is constitutional, and we were so excited and so happy, but we quickly realized we would have a challenge in Florida when they made Medicaid expansion optional. So it's now optional, and so states can opt in or opt out of doing it. And so far, Florida has said no, which I'm sure that your listeners are aware of. We had quite a battle last session, but I was so proud of the work that everybody did from all sides. It was a really amazing bipartisan effort with everybody at the table, something that I really thought we were going to be able to get done last year, and unfortunately, because of political ideology, it didn't happen. So we are back. We are ramping up our campaign, which we call the Healthcare for Florida Now campaign. The website for that is healthcareforflorida, all spelled out, .org. And basically just coming back to the table with lots of different partners, from the hospitals to physicians, to businesses, to the grassroots folks, to say we need to make this happen and get this done. So we're going to be ramping that up, and you might have already heard we do have a prominent Republican sponsor in the Senate. Senator Garcia has filed a bill that's very similar to the one from last year, Senator Negron's bill, and it does draw the federal dollars down to cover the people in our state that need this help, and there's a bill being filed in the House as well by Representative Murphy. So we are hitting the pavement and getting the word out that this issue is still very much on the table, and we're working to engage different types of groups and partners to bring as many perspectives and stories as we possibly can into our campaign. So we are quite busy, and that's all gearing up as we speak.
Well, I can't tell you how much we appreciate the hard work that you're doing, helping people get the information they need to get access to the health care, which just a little while ago, many of them were absolutely unavailable to.
You are right.
And when I think about the criticism people have of it, I wonder, what are they doing to help, or are they merely just trying to find fault?
That is true. Unfortunately, there's been so much negativity around that we really have to fight against that and what we say cutting through the noise. Cutting through the noise, staying above the fray, you know, what is our goal? What do we have in mind? We know it's working. We believe in it. And just like what you said before, it was very broken before. So certainly we had to do something. We had to try something. There's a lot of things built into the law that people don't know about. Aside from, you know, the affordability for healthcare consumers, there are also things that health insurance providers now have to do, you know, fairness, making sure that they're spending a certain amount of dollars on direct care, some really, really important things in that law. So we're still trying to get information out to people about that. I want to make sure that I say before we close that March 31st is the deadline for open enrollment. So we're encouraging people, whether or not you think you might be eligible, just go and apply. Check it out. Find out. It's really, really, really important just to go and try. Create an account and see where you stand.
Well, thanks so much, Leah. Best of luck. And please don't hesitate to call us again. And we want to keep people informed. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Leah Barber-Hines of Florida Chain. Now, before we go any further, I do want to thank our good friends and fellow progressive activists on the web and on the radio. I want to thank Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters, and Brian Stedden and his show, Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart and her Wise Women Media, Susan Nylon and her Nylon Report, Sita Baguil and her show, Sita Media, and Harriet Lehrman and her show, The Voice of the People. Also our good friend Rob Abston, all-around multimedia guy, producer, and executive director of PLAN, Progressive Leadership Action Network, a fine fellow who works very hard to keep progressive gears in motion. Now, before we go any further, I also want to, before we read another news item, I want to play you a little something in honor of Mr. Putin and his new invasion strategy.
And it's war! And it's war! Get out of the closet! Out of the horses! And it's war!
Freedom is gone to war. Each native son will grab a gun and run away to war.
At last the country's gone to war.
This is a fact we can't ignore.
We're going to war.
In case you haven't heard before, I think they think we're going to war. I think they think we're going to war.
We're going to war.
I think they think we're going to war.
We're going to war.
We're going to war.
We're going to war.
That's a
And that was our little tribute to those warmongers like Mr. Putin and that old senator from Arizona who never saw a war. He couldn't quite get behind. Gosh, he couldn't climb over there fast enough to stand next to the fascists who evidently our government is helping to fund to overthrow the other tyrant in the Ukraine. So it's just a crime, you know, what they're doing over there, that's for sure. And ladies and gentlemen, I am very proud to bring you our next guest, Miss Mindy Fetterman and her Inner Truth Project.
How are you?
Very good, very good. Welcome, Mindy. How are you tonight?
Thank you. I'm great. Thanks so much for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Well, you know, there are so many important projects that we can support. And when, you know, you think about people who've had the kind of trouble that you help them through, I think that there's not enough we can do to help publicize and help get the truth out. So, Mindy, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and about the Inner Truth Project?
Absolutely. Well, I am a mother and a wife, and more importantly, I am a survivor of sexual abuse as a child and raped twice as an adult. And about, 5 years ago, I started publicly talking about my experiences, and I did it with the hopes that people would understand that women and men who have experienced what I've experienced come in all shapes, sizes, colors, and, you know, you can't really judge a book by its cover. And when I started sharing my story, it was like people were coming out of the woodwork saying, your story is my story too. All of a sudden, everybody around me seemed to have walked in my shoes. And I guess it was something I always suspected, but I didn't really understand how pervasive of an epidemic this type of sexual abuse and rape really was. And the more people started to contact me and thank me for sharing and tell me that, you know, they'd experienced some type of violence, we realized that there was no place for us to go. There was no place for us to kind of talk about our stories and gather and heal. And I had always had this feeling that I wasn't a victim, that I was a survivor. And I don't even necessarily like to use those terms, but I just felt like, you know, I'm here, I'm alive, and I want to live the rest of my life without having the things that have happened to me in the past define my future. And there were a lot of people who wanted that message, but there was no place for us to go to get it. So I started the Inner Truth Project, and it started out just as a support group, and I had hoped that it would be for men as well as women, but we haven't quite gotten there yet. And then from the support groups, it started to turn into events and women wanting to get together and, you know, just have friendship and do workshops and see films. And so now we have this beautiful center on the Treasure Coast, and we have women from Indian River County, from Martin County, from St. Lucie County, one woman that comes up from Palm Beach County, and we have groups that meet four times a month, and we also do Pilates and yoga for PTSD so that women can have an opportunity to reconnect with their bodies, and it's growing. It's just been phenomenal.
You know, To hear your story reminds me of so many societal issues that are similar, of whether we talk about the problem of sexual abuse in the military or we talk about, you know, harassment that goes on in the workplace. I think this is so marvelous that you took this thing, transformed it in yourself, and then brought that gift to the community. People find out more about the Inner Truth Project?
They can go to the website. It's www.innertruthproject.org, and that will connect people if they choose to see us on Facebook. We've got a very active Facebook page. We tweet, and we keep all of our events posted there. We have something pretty exciting that's coming up in
I was,
the
you exactly
next month.
Anticipated my next question. What do you got coming up?
Yes. Okay, so this is something we've done before, and it's not actually our event, but we have been the first to bring it to St. Lucie and Indian River, and it's called LunaFest. And LunaFest is a film festival that is about 9 or 10 films. It changes every year, short films that are made by women from all around the world. And even though the Inner Truth Project is about finding your own inner truth and speaking with your own voice, in regards to sexual abuse and violence, the films are a nice way for us to connect with people that don't necessarily have a story, because they're about every kind of topic that you can imagine, and you come out feeling empowered. So there's films about self-esteem and dating and making money and being a parent. So it's not necessarily for somebody who maybe has been in our support groups only. Anybody
right.
can come
not
see the films
theme,
and everybody
yeah.
will get something out of it. Exactly. Yeah. So if you go to our website, it'll connect you to the LunaFest page so you can watch the trailer of all of the different films this year. And like I said, every year they change, but they're really phenomenal films. And some of them are very artistic. Some of them are animated. They're very different and unique and very beautiful. And you can get tickets right online.
Well, that's excellent. Excellent. Yeah, I'm looking at the LunaFest page right now, and it looks like some very interesting films.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, last year it was great because we had some films that I believe that were from Russia. There was one from China. There was one from South Africa. So they really are global, which is nice because we don't often get an opportunity to see what life is like for women in other parts of the world.
Do you get state support or county support at all?
Right now, everything that we've done in the past year has been by the goodness of the community and with personal donations and people just coming and opening their hearts and their wallets. We have not connected with any federal grants or any local or state organizations, but we plan on doing so. We just in the last month received our 501c3 so that we could actually apply for grants. But
excellent.
It's amazing what we've been able to do without that in the past year.
Do you have any fundraisers set up for your organization in the coming weeks?
Well, LunaFest is a fundraiser for us, and it's one of our biggest events of the year. And because it's something that's open to everybody in the community, we do anticipate to have about 300 or more people come through
uh-huh.
the center doors, learn about the center, and see the film. So that's our largest fundraiser right now. Throughout the year, we do small different events, but, you know, they're typically just a few dollars a person to come in. And we try really to focus on making sure that there's something for all of the women and their families that come through our door, not necessarily the focus on events for fundraisers. But LunaFest is our biggest fundraiser of the year.
Now, if I recall, you have a very interesting space that you hold your meetings in.
Yep, we're in a warehouse, and it's a converted space. It's 2,900 square feet, and we were so lucky because we were given the space for 11 months without rent because the landlord just really believed in what we were doing, which is amazing. However, now we do pay rent, so, you know, maybe next time I talk to you, I'll have a plea for people to come to more fundraisers because we certainly will be in need of more funds very soon because we just started paying rent a month ago.
Okay, I see you have a symposium coming up on the 1st of April.
That is actually one of our partners. It's not our symposium, but that's for the sexual assault symposium, and that'll be at the Martin County Sheriff's Office. And that's going to be a really wonderful opportunity for people who are looking to get training, how to investigate and prosecute with sexual crimes. And there's a woman that's coming to be the keynote speaker. Her name is Julie Wheel, and she's a good friend of mine and of the Inner Truth Project, and she's going to share her story, and it's quite amazing to hear her story of survivorship, and gives a lot of people hope. So even though it's not an event we're putting on, I felt very moved to make sure that people knew about it.
Sure, sure. I see you've got plenty of events that, as you said, that for the whole family that people can participate in and kind of regain their inner strength. I see the yoga classes and you mentioned the Pilates classes. It looks like a wonderful wide selection of events that you were engaged in.
We try. We really try. You know, one of the things that has occurred to us, the board and the women that we've worked with in the past year, is that, you know, we're not defined by the violence that we've lived through, and we're just regular women from every corner of the community, and we're all interested in a lot of different things. And we try to bring all of those variations into the center with the idea that we can be safe together. We had a workshop on finances. A lot of women who have experienced any type of abuse, especially early on in their life, feel very limited in their power when it comes to finances, or are afraid to be on their own and make their own choices. And so that was something that we organized that was a really educational night. And then we do things where we learn about food, about nutrition. We had a really great film, The Invisible War. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
But it's an expose on sexual violence in the military. And so that brought in a lot of our veterans, which was really wonderful. So we do try to make sure that we include as many different groups as we can.
It's such a shame when you hear about all of the sexual abuse in the military. You know, there's so much danger therein from warfare, and yet to find them in such danger from their I'm going to call it coworkers, for lack of a better term. It's just such a shame. And
well,
I'm sure you're
superior. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, we keep hearing about, oh, there'll be another investigation. There'll be another investigation. And yet, you know, we see these hearings where there's not even any women invited. I mean, it's just appalling that that women are still put upon in such, well, women and men both, put on in such difficult ways.
It's true. And, you know, you bring up an interesting point. It is men as well. And, you know, I'm grateful that we're just now getting to talk a little bit about what's happening in the military to women who are fearlessly serving our country. But we need to finally get to a point where we recognize that the abuse is happening in huge numbers to men. But the stigma is so much greater, and I think it's going to be a very long time before male survivors start talking about what's happened to them, in particular with the military. But at least we're scratching at the surface.
You know, I just recently saw an ad campaign. I can't remember where I put my finger on. Maybe you're aware of it, where it had a whole a collage of men and women's faces, people who were, in the media, in the news,
yes,
as performers,
mm-hmm,
or sports players.
I did
players.
See it, yeah.
Yeah, who were,
yeah,
all...
Yeah, we had that on the our Facebook page. And what was so cool is what you're referring to is it's people that you know from entertainment world, sports world, you know, people that we look up to, we idolize, people who are very successful. And for them to say, I went through what you went through, it's like, wow, look how many people, every color, every nationality, you know, people who look like they're so put together and that they have a perfect life, and then you find out, you know, it's not so. They've had their own trauma.
Well, you know, your site is an absolutely beautiful website. I see you got help from the Firefly Group, a fine group of progressive media people here in town.
Yes, they're wonderful. And I was looking at it while I was talking to you, and I realized that we don't have the schedule up right now of our support group. So as soon as we hang up, I'm going to fix that. it's a free free support group, and it's not therapy. A lot of us are in therapy or have been and are just looking for a different experience, something to just come together and just share our stories, our strength, and our hope. So I'm bummed that I don't have that schedule on the website at the moment. I don't know what happened to it, so I'll fix
that. Well, let me guess. You've got 50,000 irons in the fire, and it's just one of those things that you just haven't got to yet. Believe me, I can appreciate that. As a multimedia producer and web producer myself, I know there's just never enough hours in the day, the week, the month, or the year.
No, it's true. It's true. But, you know, I finally got to this place where I just said, you know what? It's just not going to get done, and life will go on. It's okay.
Yep. I can appreciate that. I really can. I was just looking at your resource center. You've got a nice, long collection of different resources people can go to, from the Safe Spaces of Treasure Coast, National Sexual Violence Resource Center, American Humane Association, Take Back the Night, Clothesline Project, Joyful Heart, Men Can Stop Rape, Devotion Series. You have a lot of great resources there. I imagine there's some members in the psychological healing community who work with you and your organization.
That's right. We do have right now 5 different therapists that we recommend our women, if they're in a place where they want to have individual therapy or go in with their family or their partner. And sometimes they'll meet with the therapist at our center, and sometimes it'll be off-site. And I think that once they come and they're comfortable at the Inner Truth Project and they like the center and they like the people there, they're a little more open to the therapist that we might recommend, as opposed to opening up the phone book or asking somebody who they don't know may or may not have an experience that they can relate to. So going through us kind of to funnel them to the different appropriate therapist, it seems to be working in a place, you know, they're more comfortable.
Oh, that's great. How many people were working with the organization now?
We've got a small board of 7 board of directors, and then we have volunteers that come and go, but it's about 15-20 women that have really been an amazing support to help put on some of the things that you just mentioned in the resources, the Take Back the Night event that we do, and the Clothesline Project, helping with LunaFest, all volunteers. We don't have any paid staff.
Well, so are you looking for volunteers to help out with the LunaFest activities?
We're always looking for volunteers, and because we hope that after LunaFest we can start organizing some more events pretty quickly, you know, it takes a lot of people to pull it off, to get the word out. And like I said, everything that we do is on a volunteer basis. Nobody is paid, so sometimes people are a little burned out or they get too busy, so we're constantly bringing in new people and looking for ways to share the workload. So if somebody is interested in volunteering, they can always contact us through the website if they're interested in finding out about going to the support groups, or even if it's something that is right for them, they can contact us anytime through the website.
Well, that's great, because, you know, so many people, you know, may not have the wherewithal to contribute financially, but they do want to help, and that's such a great thing. And, you know, a lot of times that through people's helping, they feel better about, you know, other things in their lives. So I wanted to find out if we're accepting volunteers who want to try to contribute some way.
Absolutely. You know, I can't stress that enough, because you're right. Not everybody can write a check, and that's okay, because the Inner Truth Project is about empowerment, and if somebody feels empowered to be a part of helping somebody else because they know exactly what they're going through, even if the details of their story are different, then that's what we want. We want people to feel like they are victoriously living their lives and are taking back their control and their power.
Do you, I imagine you're such a well-spoken person and have such a good handle on the issue. Do you do speaking, public speaking at, say, schools or colleges?
I do. I do a lot of public speaking. And thanks for saying that, because I always feel like after I hang up, I said too much, and I didn't have an answer. But I do talk a lot, and I do it straight from my heart. You know, I don't ever prepare, and I just feel like it's the whole idea of the Inner Truth Project, just speak your truth. And sometimes I share a little more graphically, and I go into the details of my experiences, and sometimes I just give a quick, you know, this is who we are and this is what we do. It depends on the audience.
Sure.
But I can't tell you how many times I have tried to get my foot into the door to schools, and we're just not there yet. I'm working on it. That it's my goal, because so many of the people that come to me privately are high school girls.
I would presume that that's such an important audience for the wisdom that you can share. College girls, high school girls, and boys for that matter.
Absolutely.
Because,
absolutely.
And unfortunately, the civilization we seem to be in these days has a great deal of reluctance to face some scientific facts. And if they're having trouble talking about birth control, I would imagine that sexual violence is something that's even further away from subjects they can feel comfortable with. And that's a shame.
Yeah.
We are all poor because of that. But I know your honesty, I'm sure will just shine right through that. And I wish you every success trying to get into the schools.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it scares people. It scares people, and you know, we still live in a culture of victim blaming, and you know, people believe that if they can get girls to behave a certain way, then they wouldn't have any type of violence against them, which of course we know is absolutely ludicrous. But you know, it's one
some
step
very
at
advanced
time.
17th century thinking.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And it does require taking your head out of the sand. And, you know, so many of the people who don't want us to come in and talk to the kids about it have had their own experience. So they're not dealing with their own shame. So it's cyclical, it's generational, and, you know, like I said, it's so pervasive. So if you've got somebody who's the gatekeeper, so to speak, and they've got their own demons, it makes it even harder to
sure.
get around that person to speak to a wider audience, but we're getting there. And
we have some people coming up in a week or two who are going to talk about the AIDS problem in this area. And
yes.
Of course, ignorance is the first stepping stone to infection. And you know, your ability to explain to how to empower oneself, how to protect oneself, I'm sure would be instrumental in real reduction in that danger, and it's just such
yeah.
a shame.
Well, last year and the year before, when we did Take Back the Night, which is an event where we march through the streets and then we have an open forum where people can come share their experience for the very first time publicly, telling their story. And for the first 2 years, we worked very closely with the crusaders in our community who are working to get people tested and educated about HIV. And the whole idea, because the first Take Back the Night we did was on World AIDS Day on December 1st, so we
uh-huh.
created this whole weekend of events, and the whole idea was to create a shame-free zone, because
right.
the secrets are going to kill us, whether it's, you know, finding out your HIV status, whether it's talking about somebody in your family that was a perpetrator, whatever it is, holding on to that secret almost spreads like a cancer. And there's a lot of people who need that message all across the board, you know, letting their secrets out and finding out, wow, I don't have anything to be ashamed of. I don't have anything to be afraid of because there's people just like them who are willing to support them.
Yeah, I knew a gentleman who was a professional boxer, and he had a medical condition that if had he had the research done, you know, he could have either put his mind to rest or known what the next steps were, but he refused to do the diagnosis because he would rather be in ignorance than know what was really going on. And I just found that so unfortunate and so appalling. You know, we all have to face the realities in front of us.
Right. And, you know, more often than not, there are ways to get help, but sometimes we're our own worst enemies.
Sure. That's for sure. So Mindy, you know, you're doing this fine work. How long has the Inner Truth Project been in operation?
We just hit our year mark, our 1 year mark, although the support groups, it's been a little over 2 years, and the support groups were kind of in rotating locations until
uh-huh.
we finally got our own space. But the actual Inner Truth Project and the center, it's just a year.
Well, that's amazing when you think about all the lives you have touched and people you've helped in just that short period of time. I hope you allow yourself a smile at the hard work that you've mm-hmm. accomplished in these few years. I want to thank you for coming on. If there was a few things you wanted to share with people before we go, what would you say to a young woman or a young man who's had these unfortunate experiences?
Well, I'll tell you this. I appreciate that you remind me to smile because it's part of all of our recovery. And the thing that I'm the most proud of is that I'm sitting right here next to my 8-year-old son who listened to the whole thing I just said. And part of it's because he doesn't want to go to bed. But part of it is because I always include him on my conversations. And he looked at me and he smiled just now and he said, good job. And it reminds me that we don't have to be so afraid to talk about these things. When we talk about it without fear, that's how we start breaking this cycle of violence. And if you are somebody listening and you're a mother or you're a father and you're afraid that if your children find out or if your parents find out that they will shame you or blame you, you know, take a step and try to find one person that you can talk to. And from there, you'll realize that you can start sharing your secret so that it's not a secret anymore. And I think most people will feel relieved. There are a lot of services that can help. And there's a lot of people that we feel are going to judge us, and they just don't. They don't. And it truly does set you free. It's scary as all get out, but I believe the first step is using your voice and just telling one other person what's happened.
Well, thank you so very much. I really appreciate you coming on, Mindy. You have a voice that must be heard, and you tell a truth that can heal so many people. I wish you every success.
Thank you so much, Richard, and thank you again for inviting me back, and I hope that we can do it again.
Well, I absolutely am going to count on you to do that, and when you have an event you want to help, let us help you promote, please let me know, okay?
And I would love to meet you in person.
Well, one of these days, I'm going to make it up there. Maybe I can make it to part of the LunaFest, my wife and I. We'd be very honored to meet you.
Absolutely. I would as well, so I'm gonna hold you to that.
Okay. You take care.
Have a great
good night. And
thank you. Bye-bye.
Sweet dreams to your boy.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. That was Mindy Fetterman of the Inner Truth Project, an absolutely wonderful guest, and we hope to have her back again soon. I do want to close with a couple more news stories, and I want to remind you that you can get more details and links if you go to averyvoice.com. That's AveryVoice.com, and you can get a lot more details on the news stories that we do. A news story from Japan also. Radiation from Japan's leaking Fukushima nuclear plant has reached the waters offshore Canada, researchers said today at the annual American Geophysical Union's Ocean Sciences meeting in Honolulu. Is the Fukushima radiation spreading far, and is there any way to tell it's from Japan? Two radioactive cesium isotopes, cesium-134 and cesium-137, have been detected offshore of Vancouver, British Columbia, researchers said at a news conference. The detected concentrations are much lower than the Canadian safety limit for cesium in drinking water, said John Smith, research scientist at Canadian Bedford Institute of Oceanography in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. Tests concluded at U.S. beaches indicate that Fukushima radiation has not reached Washington, California, or Hawaii, said Ken Boozler, senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Another story on the terrorism front. In the U.K., journalism is terrorism. This is from The Intercept magazine, recently started with funds from Pierre Almodovar, the Glenn Greenwald, and Mr. Scahill are involved in. UK government expressly argued that the release of Snowden's documents, which the free world calls award-winning journalism, is actually tantamount to terrorism. The same theory now being used by the Egyptian military regime to prosecute Al Jazeera journalists as terrorists. Congratulations to the UK government on the illustrious company it keeps. Once again, British officials have also repeatedly threatened criminal prosecution of everyone involved in this reporting, including Guardian journalists and editors. You remember the famous scenes of them drilling holes in the hard drives, even though the files were stored on a cloud network. Equating journalism with terrorism has a long storied tradition. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I want to remind you that I hope you tune in next week. Next week, we're going to be talking about immigration with some wonderful guests from mass media in California. I want to thank once again personally Shirley Santino. Shirley has been wonderful helping us get some special guests that really have helped to broaden the show. So thanks, Shirley. We really appreciate it. And again, tune in. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, news director of Progressive News Network. Be well, and we'll see you soon. Paul Rope says,
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Did I but Joe, he 10 years dead, I never died, said he. I never died, said he. In Salt Lake City, said I, and standing by my bed, they framed you on a murder charge, said Joe, but I'm dead, said Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. It's more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling near his eyes, says Joe, what hate can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, there you find your hill.
Thank you. Yeah.